Broadcasting live from the Wake Forest Business Radio X studios in North Carolina, it's time for Carolina Connections, the radio show where business leaders connect.
Hello, this is your host, Ann Revell-Petcher on Carolina Connections. I'm here with our producer, Reed Powell. Hello, Reed.
Hello, Ann. How are you?
I'm fabulous. This nice, like, break in the weather just is getting my mind working on, like, all eight cylinders today.
It's 80 degrees. Feels really
it
cool
feels
when it's been 90.
Fabulous. It feels fabulous. So, Reed, we have a really interesting show today. You know what it's going to do?
What?
It's going to give all of our listeners a really good understanding about the breadth and depth of business and living in Carolina.
Nice.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. We have a studio full of people. We have four guests today. We're going to, in a few minutes, be speaking with Lauren Gold, who's the Executive Vice President of the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau. Hello, Lauren.
Hey, Ann. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us in the studio.
Great to be here.
We also have Clayton D'Souza, who's with Data Chambers. Hello, Clayton.
Good morning, Ann. How are you?
I'm great. Everybody's wondering, now, how are you going to do Data Chambers and the visitors Convention and Visitors Bureau in the same show? You just wait a second, because our next guest is Mark Wilson, who's the VP of Marketing at Cambridge Village Senior Living. Hello, Mark.
Good morning, Ann.
Great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
And we have Gary Hayes, who's with Scale Finance. Hello, Gary.
Good morning, Ann. It's great to be here. Looking forward to it.
I'm glad you're here, too. Hey, Gary, I'm just going to start by asking you to give us a sense of what Scale Finance is and how you're different from a lot of the other firms out there.
Well, again, I appreciate the opportunity of being on this morning. So Scale Finance is a six-year-old company, and we're a professional services company, and we provide basically two services. Our primary business is what we call our fractional or part-time accounting services, where we deploy CFOs, controllers, accounting managers to small businesses. The other aspect of our business is really what we call transaction advisory support, where we'll assist companies that need access to capital. So that can be in the form of debt or equity. So we have expertise on both sides of that. So they're very synergistic with each other. So that's what we've done, and we've built a nice client base by offering those services.
That's really interesting. So half of the business, and the way the business was founded was as a fractional CFO?
That's correct.
And then you've added, and how did you refer to the second half of the
business?
Transaction
advisory support.
Transaction advisory. So it sounds to me as though you work primarily with small to medium-sized businesses.
Yes. The target audience are companies from, we call it 0 to 20 million. The bulk are really between 2 million in revenue. We use revenue as a general benchmark.
Sure.
But 2 million to 10, 12 million is the target audience where the fractional or part-time support really works well.
Mm-hmm. And then on the fund side, do you work with a lot of startups in that environment?
Yeah, typically we about half our client base, which is we have approximately 100 active accounts in the territories we work in, and so about half of that is technology-based businesses, and that's in the broad definition of tech. Mm-hmm. So it's software, hardware on one side, and then your life science, med device, biopharma, biotech on the other side.
So you're in the right spot.
We believe so.
I think so, based on what we're hearing. So are you just here in the Triangle?
No. Actually, my partner, our co-founder, a gentleman named Dave Gilroy, is based in Charlotte. So he and I started the firm, about 6-7 years ago. And we cover almost the entire state of North Carolina with our major presences here in the Triangle, as well as in Charlotte, also in Greensboro, down towards Southern Pines, Pinehurst, a little bit in the Wilmington market. Over the past 2 years, we've tried to branch out now or expand. So now we have a couple of folks in the Florida market, two up in the DC market, and just recently added our first person in Atlanta.
Wow. So you're pretty much covering the Southeast these days.
Our real goal is to cover the Southeast.
So how does the fractional CFO work? Does somebody literally come in and work in your office every day of the week and go to board meetings and the like?
Well, depending on the role, we staff at basically three levels. We have CFOs, we have controllers, and accounting managers. So that allows us to deploy the right level resource to the tasks that need to be done. So we're not trying to force fit a CFO to do an accounting task. So our basic our preference is to always work on site because it really helps having that face-to-face time with the client. Now, it may only be a half a day a week. It could be a day a week, et cetera. But we do prefer that we work on site, but we also can work remotely.
Hmm. And on the flip side, the clients that are looking for growth capital, how do you help them?
All right. So that can happen in a variety of ways. Typically, we may start with our fractional accounting support with our CFOs who have done that extensively in the past, either with us or on their in their prior lives. But if they need to raise capital in a formal way, the big differentiator for scale is that we have two people on our team that are what we call registered reps, and we have two different affiliations with broker dealers, so we can formally raise capital in that under that sense, as compared to just kind of helping out.
So it's more than just introducing people to people,
right? So we have on the tech side or the technology side of a business, and companies are looking to raise, a formal Series A or Series B round. Our institutional realm, then we can we have a database of over 500 venture firms across the firm that we know them pretty well, and we can reach out to them and do a very efficient process for them. On the debt side, we have several hundred lenders that we work with, mm-hmm. and typically the debt piece is for companies a little bit further along. Unfortunately, lending institutions like companies that have some earnings, or at least are getting close to earnings, which is why we start with equity and then move to debt. But our later stage companies can generally support a debt piece, so we have access to that type of capital as well.
I want to go back to the entrepreneur for just a second, because I think that's where we first met, was at an entrepreneurial event, probably with CED.
That's correct.
And entrepreneurs, early stage entrepreneurs, I mean very early stage entrepreneurs, obviously they don't have income yet, but they definitely need to find finance. And they're not going to go to a venture probably. Venture firms are probably also not interested at too early of a stage. How can you help somebody who's early stage?
Well, I just emceed or moderated a panel a few months ago on bootstrapping. And this was focused more on the pure tech, software, hardware types of businesses. But mm-hmm. The key advice from my perspective with really early stage companies is to focus on the customer, the target customer you're going after, and your solution, and to get it out there as quickly as possible and let the customer determine if it's viable or not.
Yeah.
What holds companies back, I find a lot of CEOs or CEO entrepreneur types are rushing to raise the capital too soon. And because they haven't proven that there is, there's a real business need yet, or their solution really addresses it, or the market's too small. There's lots of reasons to say no, right? So, what we encourage is let's get it out there, especially on the software side. It doesn't cost nearly as much as it used to.
Yeah.
To build a product is to get it out there in the marketplace, get some initial customers, even if they're only paying a very modest amount for it. And because investors, whether you're institutional or angel, it doesn't really matter too much. As long as there's customers, it's a viable market, it's large, you'll start to get interest if you have that.
Yeah. So. You guys have really grown a lot over the last little while. When were you founded?
We started Scale in the fall of 2008. We were together for about a year before that, but then we sorted it all out and branded it as Scale Finance in the fall of 2008.
That was really brave of you.
Right. It wasn't. We looked up and then Lehman Brothers blew up. So it wasn't. But we actually found that the poor economy that resulted actually helped our business as we emerged into 2009. Unfortunately, one thing about what we do, accounting work doesn't really go away. It still has to be done. and the companies that we support that might have been on the verge of hiring full-time resources, didn't because of the economy. And, this part-time solution was sitting there. And I think it really helped our growth. And we've been averaging 30% growth since we started.
Wow. So what's impacting your continued success here?
Well, I mean, it's easier growing 30% when you're tiny, but as you get bigger, it gets harder. So that's part of the reason why we're trying to expand into new markets.
Yeah.
North Carolina has been wonderful for us. We've got over, we have about 45 people on our team now total, And about 30, I don't know, about 35 of those are in North Carolina.
Wow, that's great.
And so we think we have ample opportunity to grow, especially in the more distant markets like Florida and D.C. and Atlanta, as well as to continue to expand in North Carolina.
That's great. This is great. If somebody is at a stage where they could really use your help, how do they get a hold of you?
Well, they can clearly go to our website, which is scalefinance.com.
Okay.
If you go to our professional page, they're sorted by territory. You can reach out that way. You can obviously contact me directly at hayes@scalefinance.com. That's my email address. And so either way works very well.
That's great. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Ann.
We're going to scoot over here and have a conversation today with Mark Wilson, who's with Cambridge Village Senior Living. Mark, welcome to the show.
Good morning again.
Mark, you and I first met actually in Wilmington because you have a really exciting new facility that you're developing in Wilmington. Why don't you give the audience a little background on what Cambridge Senior Living is and your facilities here in Apex and in Wilmington?
Sure. Well, it's interesting hearing Gary's story about 2009. We began about 5 years ago looking at developing a new brand of senior living communities with the Cambridge Village name as our brand. And obviously back in 2008, 2009, that was kind of a scary prospect
because
of the economy, as well as the fact that a lot of people that are looking at senior living options, the main thing that they kind of, one sticking point is you have to sell your home before you can move. And that was obviously kind of a roadblock for a little while. But having been able to start at that point, I think we are a real advantage right now. So, like I said, the company kind of had its genesis from the owners being in the nursing home business for about 25 years. Kendall Oliver is the main primary owner of the company, and about 10 years ago he built his first facility on his own, and it was called Cambridge Hills, and it's in Roxborough. It's an assisted living community. So
why don't we take 1 second, and can you tell us the difference between a nursing home and an assisted living facility?
Sure.
and a senior
so that's a great question, because I think that this has relevance as we start to talk a little bit about how Cambridge Village is different from some of the other senior living options. Back in the early 80s, you really had kind of a a genesis, a new format for senior living. Prior to that, it was pretty much nursing homes, rest homes were kind of the where you put your mom and dad when they were ready to
when
go there.
They couldn't
there.
Live on their own
right.
anymore. Right.
And I think they saw at that point that there were certainly a lot of younger seniors that were looking for something more than just some place to sit and rock on the front porch. So what happened was that there were sort of two different types of facilities that emerged from that. One was assisted living, which, as the name implies, it was providing some additional assistance to in the way of providing meals, housekeeping, that sort of thing, mm-hmm. as well as just providing a safe environment for those seniors. What emerged out of that was another type of community called a continuing care retirement community. And this is actually a licensed and both assisted living and CCRCs, continuing care retirement communities, are licensed by the state. But the advantage of the continuing care retirement communities was that they actually offered both a variety of different levels of care, starting with what we would call independent living, mm-hmm. which are basically just apartments that offer an umbrella of services, and then assisted living. And then the third one was sort of the next step, which would be some sort of skilled nursing.
Skilled nursing.
And this was all on the same campus.
So the benefit there is that you develop a community when you move in, and you don't have to be taken out of your community, really. You are still with the same group of people.
That's exactly
as you
right.
progress.
Yeah, and that was very popular. The problem with that was, or as we've gone forward, if you fast forward to today, is that continuing care retirement communities have kind of come out of, not so much out of favor, but It's typically requires some kind of investment. It's an equity purchase of the apartment or cottage, or right. maybe there's a buy-in that you don't get it back. If you were to pass away, you couldn't give it to your heirs. So what we're seeing is a trend in the industry more toward rental type of communities, and that's really where Cambridge Village landed. We developed the first community was, as you mentioned, in Apex. We opened about 3 years ago, and that is a rental community. We have about 120 apartments, and mm-hmm. so we offer, and we started out offering this independent retirement setting. So the
so what's that life like? The independent retirement.
Yeah. So the nice thing about the independent retirement setting is that people who are still healthy mm-hmm. and want to basically enjoy a lifestyle that provides them with the freedom that independent living offers, but also has the benefits of being able to be provided with dining services, housekeeping, transportation, entertainment, physical fitness, all sure. those things under one roof is really what Cambridge Village offered in a rental format.
Okay, very nice. So what's unique about your environment there is that it's a rental environment as opposed to a buy-in.
Certainly, that's the first thing. And that's what I think we'd like the notion as we move forward that of the continuing care retirement community format, and that being, as you pointed out, that you can move in, and as you age, you can kind of age in place. So as you need higher levels of care, you can be able to get those without having to move to another facility.
Yeah.
And this is something that we've evolved over that even within the last 3 years. So in order to do that, we have come up with a different model. And this was based primarily on, I think, the fact that the owners were in the nursing home business and skilled nursing and understood a lot about what the burden of all the regulations were associated with that
right.
environment. So their model really wanted to be that they provided these same services, but in a more of a virtual state. And so what we've done is we partnered with different healthcare groups.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea.
To be able to provide those services while at the same time we don't have staff of nurses on our staff at Cambridge Village.
Mm-hmm.
Our focus is primarily providing those independent services of dining, physical fitness in our wellness center, as well as the activities and robust programming that we have, as well as the transportation and that
so
sort of thing.
I hear your facilities, your workout facilities are fabulous. You have like pools and water aerobics and a great gym.
Right.
People get a workout buddy.
Well, we felt like that one of the things that as you kind of look toward people that are thinking about retiring, not also have already reached that age, but as we look at the baby boomers and looking down about 10 years from now, we see that the kinds of facilities and the types of programs that are going to be expected to be available in senior living options is considerably different than mm-hmm. what it is today and,
sure.
and what it certainly was 5 or 10 years ago. And one of those is certainly the idea that people want to continue to stay active.
Right.
And so we've developed what we call a format called Wellness as a Lifestyle. And this really focuses around what we call a holistic wellness approach, which would include not only physical wellness, but intellectual wellness, spiritual wellness, and social wellness. So all of our programming is really designed around that.
That's great.
Concept.
That's really great. So you're expanding in Apex. This must be going well.
Yeah, well, we've actually, we're building all these projects, and you mentioned the one in Wilmington that's under construction right now, in phases. And so the project in Apex, we're 3 years old, and we're into our third phase of expansion in that.
That's
so we'll
great.
Be.
And when does Wilmington open?
Wilmington opens early in 2015, and it's also being built in phases. It'll be 120 apartments with about a 28,000 square foot clubhouse. We're actually building a 25,000 square foot wellness center for that facility, which is about double the size of the one in Apex.
And it's close to the beach.
Absolutely. About 2 miles, actually.
So if somebody's thinking about, you know, starting to plan for this, how can they get in touch with you to learn a little bit more about how Cambridge Village is different?
Probably the easiest way is just to go to cvsliving.com, which is Cambridge Village Senior Living.
And it's not a drugstore.
That's right. Easier to remember that way.
That's great. Super. Thanks for coming back on the show, Mark. Now, we're going to talk data. We got, as we know, you know, as I was talking to Mark, you know, Mark's in an industry where, at least in the Wilmington area, almost 30% of the audience is available to his particular demographic, believe it or not. And it's actually, in this area, it's in the 20%, average 20-25% area. That's a big chunk. But I look at the business community here, Clayton D'Souza, and I can't imagine that there's anybody who doesn't need the Data Chambers solution.
Good morning, Ann, and thanks for having me. You're right. I mean, typically in this marketplace, given the concentration of technology and other verticals such as healthcare and finance, all of these different verticals at some form or fashion use technology, and that lends itself to leveraging a provider like Data Chambers that can kind of meet those initiatives for them.
So I got to see one of the Data Chambers facilities here. It is so cool when you think about what Data Chambers is and does. You essentially do more than just hold people's data.
Absolutely. We are a complete IT infrastructure services company. And so what that means is we house all of businesses' IT equipment, but we also manage their systems. We do monitoring. We do backups. We do business continuity and disaster recovery as well for them, just depending on what customers are looking for. And so what this does is it takes care of every back office infrastructure need that a customer may have.
It's interesting. You know, it kind of takes a different mindset to think about having your technology, your physical technology, your servers stored somewhere else than on site. And I'm old and I've been doing this a really long time. So, you know, when my 20 megabyte hard drive was the size of, I don't know, a huge suitcase, those were, you know, older days. But why are people needing to have all of their IT services off-site now?
Generally, what we found is this is when customers look for a services provider like Data Chambers, they're trying to meet one of four critical criteria, what I call the four C's, which is basically either they're trying to meet compliancy, where they're bound by HIPAA or Sarbanes-Oxley or Gramm-Leach-Leibler, any one of these compliancy requirements, they need to be in a facility that meets all of those requirements. The other factor is cost, because what it takes to maintain and manage a data center is a significant investment when you think of the power redundancies, the internet connectivity, the cooling that goes along with that. So in order to mitigate some of that cost, what a company will do is leverage a provider like Data Chambers, where they turn an OPEX into basically a CAPEX into an OPEX and just basically lease a fraction of a Tier 3 facility.
So
just some of the things that go into place. And then the other things that they look at is also criticality, where a data center may have a critical application that needs to be running 24/7. And a lot of times when you're in a building, whether it be a leased building or what have you, you're at the mercy of the landlord of the building and dealing with the redundancies that are in that facility, not necessarily in your office or in your business. So you tend to have your own gensets. You tend to have your own redundant connections.
And that gets expensive.
And exactly. So therein comes the, like you said, the cost considerations, and also making sure that these systems are always up and always running and can never go down. Like, for instance, a lot of some of the customers that we house actually have critical public sector applications that are running that could necessarily be hospitals or healthcare facilities or things like that. And these are things that need to be running in times of emergency. So that's why that's the critical aspect of why people would use this as well.
On the data center side, what is it about your specific data centers that make you so trustworthy?
Well, one of the things that, I mean, and to give you a little bit of background on Data Chambers, we were actually founded in 2002, and we were headquartered in Winston-Salem. Mm-hmm. And the facilities that were built over there, the first two facilities, were actually built in a 20 megaton nuclear bunker, which was 20 feet underground. So, I mean, it was actually, we were able to take advantage of some of the the resources that were already there at the facility and leverage that. I mean, so this was a facility that was actually being used by the government. And so we took all the redundancies that were already in place and we built a data center using
that.
Great
idea.
And so with that came the notion that Data Chambers is a secure facility that's always available and always running. And so when we came to the Raleigh marketplace in 2012, we couldn't come here with a substandard product, so to speak, because we were known for that that brand and known to be that provider that's a very stable and very secure and reliable facility. So that's one of the things that we look at when we basically pitch data center services to customers. We provide that level of security. And at the end of the day, we're selling trust. I mean, and trust is a very nebulous thing to sell.
Yeah, that's a very difficult thing to sell. So who is the ideal customer?
So an ideal customer would be anybody that's looking to outsource some of their applications and basically alleviate some of those, looking for cost savings. They're also looking to meet a critical initiative where, like as I mentioned earlier, they're looking to have the data center, their application running 24/7,
mm-hmm.
and basically looking to leverage some of the resources and the services that we offer and augment their staff as well.
So this could be, you'd mentioned hospitals.
Oh, absolutely.
This could be law firms.
It could be anybody. We generally, most of our customer base is generally in the SMB market, but we've also serviced like enterprise customers just looking to turn that CapEx into an OpEx, like I said, and eliminate those investments in hardware and basically redundancies to keep that hardware up and running. So
you have a facility in Winston-Salem?
Yes, we do. We've got two facilities in Winston-Salem. We just opened one a couple of years back, actually last year, I should say, in Raleigh. And sometime next year, in the beginning of next year, I would say late January, early Feb, we'll be opening our fourth facility in Kannapolis, North Carolina, which will be on the North Carolina Research Campus.
That's very cool. So you work really closely in a lot of different organizations, a lot of different nonprofits in the region. I know that you're tied to the North Carolina Technology Association, obviously, because you need to be a part of that
Absolutely.
Community. What other organizations are you involved with?
Some of the organizations that we work with closely are folks like AFCOM, which are facilities IT facilities-based organizations that deal with infrastructure and data centers and critical facilities like that. Other things that we do, we've also worked with CED, the Center for Entrepreneurial Development, and Ty Carolinas as well.
Oh, cool.
So.
Very cool. We've had a few people on the show lately that are in the commercial real estate end of the world, that are in the recruiting end of the world. And they keep saying that one of the greatest things that North Carolina has to offer is its ability to deal with data centers. Why do you think that is?
Absolutely. It's because of the ability to get power really cheap over here, in the sense that a lot of businesses open up their data centers over here because the utilities over here look very favorably on people opening up data centers and providing.
Okay.
You're able to get really sustainable, good, cheap power compared to the Northeast and the West Coast. So it makes it a very attractive proposition for folks like a Google or what have you as well to open up facilities.
Yeah. How'd you get into this?
Started actually, believe it or not, about 15 years ago, and I was in IT and kind of went to school, got a computers information degree, and then happened to be working at a web hosting company and just kind of got my feet wet in there and liked what I was doing, and kind of, as they say, the rest is history.
What kind of trends are you seeing since you've gone through this sort of change from web hosting to
One of the biggest things we're seeing now is what we like to call infrastructure as a service, or as people normally know, cloud computing.
Sure.
A lot of businesses are moving away from the traditional physical hardware and kind of, like you said, the big servers that everybody knows of and trying to house those pieces of equipment. People are now moving to the utilities computing and pay as you drink and only use the resources that you need. Gone are the days where they're looking for physical boxes or space. It's just now give me as much processing as I need, as much compute as I need, and as much storage as I need.
So do they look to you to make those decisions for them?
Absolutely. And that's one of our key offerings that we provide for customers with is cloud services. And we do everything from co-tenant cloud environments to private dedicated cloud environments, just depending on customers' needs.
Yeah, it's a big sea change, isn't it? The Absolutely. Whole cloud computing thing. So if somebody is interested in some help with their IT and offsite storage for their data, how do they get in touch with you?
Absolutely. The first thing they would do is you can either go to datachambers.com, which is our website, mm-hmm. or they can reach out to me personally at cdesouza@datachambers.com.
Why don't you spell D'Souza for me?
Yeah, I was going to say, because I know that's not a commonplace last name, but it's D-S-O-U-Z as in zebra A. at datachambers.com, and or basically get on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn as well. They can reach out that way too.
Okay, that's great. Thanks cool. for your time. Thank you. It's great to hear about it. Lauren Gold, Executive Vice President of the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau, welcome to the station.
Great to be
again.
Here
again. Yep. Hey, Lauren, you know, everybody's probably sitting here thinking, what in God's name are you thinking having the convention center on with people like Data Chambers and the senior living and the CFO fractionals? What's going on? My theory here is that you are the first touch that most people have when they come to North Carolina, that they come in and they come through our fabulous Raleigh Convention Center and touch your visitors bureau, and you are the first person to help them understand what North Carolina has to offer. Think that's right?
Yeah, I think so in most cases. Do want to differentiate, though. We are the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau, so we act as a quasi-government nonprofit. Our partner is the Raleigh Convention Center.
Okay,
so that team at the Convention Center is city-managed. They also run the assets over at Red Hat Amphitheater and the Performing Arts Complex. But we are physically, some days, connected at the hip in a lot of what we do. But most definitely, we want to always be the first point of contact. And if nothing else, we hope that the visitor in coming to North Carolina and, more importantly, coming to Raleigh or Greater Raleigh in the Wake County area is going to use some of our assets, our resources to you know, look up, search out, find attractions, find hotels and things of that nature mm-hmm. from a content standpoint. So,
so what do you offer?
Well, we are as I said, we're a quasi-government nonprofit. We have a staff of 25 people, and really our primary goal is to take visitor lodging tax. So anytime a visitor comes to the area and stays in a hotel, there's a lodging tax that's generated, as well as the food and beverage prepared tax in Wake County. Those two funds make up what we refer to as the interlocal tax, and the interlocal tax is generating somewhere around $37 million a year. Portions of that tax go out to fund our organization, so we act as what we refer to in the industry as a destination marketing organization. Mm-hmm. So our primary goal is to be out there marketing to visitors, both on what we refer to the leisure transient side. Those are folks that are coming in to access food, concerts, music, visiting friends and relatives
sure.
are in that category. There's the business transient customer. Those are the business folks that come in to call on all the great companies in our backyard. And then there are the group segment, which is made up of conventions and meetings, as well as youth and amateur and some professional sporting
events.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we have a whole sports marketing side to our business as
wow.
well.
Wow, yeah. Well, fun. So how many visitors do we see here in Wake County every year?
2013 statistics, we brought in about 13.2 million visitors, up from about 12.4 the previous year.
Oh,
and some of the previous speakers, Mark and Clayton and Gary, have all referenced back to 2008. We dipped actually down below 10 million. So we've been climbing steadily back up over the last 6 years, about a million visitors incrementally year over year.
Wow, that's great.
Which is wonderful. Yeah.
And how does that impact our economy here?
Well, those visitors bring, based on our tracking and our work with a couple of third-party aggregators in the Division of Tourism for the state of North Carolina, bring in about $2 billion in direct. That's billion with a B, direct spending to our county. So those are folks that are accessing, as I said, hotels, retail spending, food and beverage spending and
yeah.
restaurants, things of that nature.
Cool.
Yeah.
You know, one of the biggest push that we have on and certainly tech and life science side of our industries here in North mm-hmm. Carolina is jobs. We have a lot of openings right now for people in the technology sector especially. And I'm just curious how travel and tourism impacts jobs here.
Yeah. So countywide in what we track, we're about 22,000 employees. So, you know, if you scale it in the, you know, top 10 or 12, 15 industries, we probably fall somewhere to middle to the lower, the half of that. But 22,000 employees that are employed in hotels and restaurants and retail and attractions, you know, folks mm-hmm. that are affiliated with the museums and the various music venues that are
oh,
around
yeah.
the county are accounted in that as well.
And they get to read our newspapers and learn that as they travel here, they should actually just stay here, and they should just live here, and they
that's funny. It depends on who you talk to on that subject, but we view it as, you know, it's clean money that comes into the economy.
Yeah.
You know, outside visitors bringing their own hard-earned dollars from whatever port of call they're coming from and coming and leaving it. In the county, you know, those visitors generate about $191 million in taxes.
Yes.
About 96 of that goes to local, and 95 of it goes to the state.
That's
so
great.
Yeah, most definitely.
So we've only lived in North Carolina for 3 years now, and
okay.
My husband has never spent any time in Raleigh.
Uh-oh.
Except for to drive through. So we're actually going to come and we're going to, you know, we live at the beach. So we're going to come up from the beach and
sure.
spend the weekend in a couple weeks in Raleigh so that I can show him around and show him what's cool. What kind of things do you think that I should make sure that I show him?
Well, I think where we're seeing a lot of traction right now from our visitors are in a couple different categories. And we've broken it down in the world of destination marketing. It really has become very experiential. You as mm-hmm. a visitor have certain things that you like, certain hobbies that you like, and you want to find that unique experience to the destination. So we categorically, and we even do this in our web space, we try to break it out for, you know, music lovers, foodies, folks that are into the visual and performing arts,
mm-hmm.
What we refer to as the creative genius category.
Yeah.
Those that are into cultural and heritage, and then the adrenaline junkies, those are folks that are both into participatory and fan-based sports and recreation. So those are the big five categories. So I'd almost put the question back to
okay,
what do
so
you
and
your husband...
Okay, so he used to run a theater. He used to run the Alliance Theater in Atlanta.
Great.
So do we have theater here?
We do. We do have quite a bit of theater, starting downtown and then kind of flowing out to the entire county because our organization represents the entire county. We've got four theaters in downtown at the Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts.
Okay.
So Mamondi Concert Hall, the symphony plays there. North Carolina Theater's there. And the Broadway Theater, North Carolina Opera is there. And the Carolina Ballet. So those are all
great.
Self-contained right downtown in a four-theater complex. There are some great community theaters out there as well. Not only the Raleigh Little Theater up towards NC State University, but even down in communities like Garner.
Mm-hmm.
North Carolina, Holly Springs, Cary's got a great performing arts complex. They converted the old Cary school, which was
yeah.
the former high school way back, and then it became the elementary school. They flipped that into a whole arts complex in downtown Cary. So there's some great community theater as well, if that's what you're into.
Cool.
A lot of those can be accessed on our website. We have a whole full calendar of events that runs throughout the year.
Well, as a quasi-government agency, you know, this is something coming from Atlanta. I have to say it was really hard in Atlanta to have each of the counties, which had all of their own environment, you know, economic development organizations pushing just their county. And
right.
they didn't play well together terribly all the time anyway.
Yeah.
Sometimes they stepped it up. But you're really about Raleigh. How about, do you ever have overlap with the Durhams, the Chapel Hills?
We do. That's a great question. And at times we do get kind of pigeonholed or centric to Raleigh, but as I mentioned, we're greater Raleigh, so it's all 12 municipalities within Wake County, even destinations like Wake Forest, where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
So we market all those municipalities, but we do some dual initiatives with Durham. Raleigh and Durham have a tendency to get lumped together, not only at the airport, but other ports of call. So we do, speaking of the arts, we've done some arts outreach. We've done a wine trail. There's some small wineries.
There's a wine trail?
There is a small wine trail that flows
in
between the various municipalities between Orange County and Durham County
really?
and Wake County. We have there's a great, those, it's kind of the foodie category, but craft
yeah.
brewing is very big in the state now.
Yeah.
We're up to, we're pushing 20 craft breweries just here in Wake County, and then there's some wonderful ones in Durham as well and around the General Triangle. So if you're into craft brews, you can kind of hit a craft brew trail as well. So there
if
is some
crossover.
You can get
someone else to drive for you, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But I think that the most important thing to note, and that we're very aware of it, is that in the destination marketing side of things, a visitor is going to go where they want to go, regardless
right.
of, you know, physical municipal domain. They're going to cross from one county to the next to seek out those experiential experiences.
You bet.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you have a physical location, a visitors bureau location where people
we
can
do.
Go?
We do. We're headquartered right in downtown at 421 Fayetteville Street. That's our operational offices. And then directly across the street from there, where the Raleigh Marriott City Center is,
mm-hmm.
Right on Fayetteville Street, in the physical public space. We call it the connector. there is a visitor center that we run.
Is that where all the little restaurants are sort of outside?
Yeah, just behind it, yeah, just behind that, right off of the porte cochere of the Marriott.
Okay.
Just as you're accessing the Raleigh Convention Center, there's a full-blown convention center there, or a visitor center there that runs from 9 to 5, and then it runs from noon to 5 on Saturdays.
Okay.
It's fully staffed, so you can walk in, get your maps and guides and things like that.
Get some ideas.
Yep, absolutely.
When you don't feel like having another screen in front of you because you're on vacation.
Absolutely.
That's great. So if somebody is listening and wants to plan an outing, how would they get in touch with you?
Visitraleigh.com is the easiest way to do that. If you're on a mobile phone, visit raleigh.mobi as well.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, you guys. We have had a really fun conversation here. I really appreciate everybody's time, giving us some insight into some of the businesses that are making North Carolina a great place to live and do business. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ann.
Thank you, Ann.
Thank you. And until next time, this is Ann Ravel-Petcher for Carolina Connections.